Welcome to Watching Silent Films. This is Yifang with me and my co-hosts Bob and Lily. Hello, greetings.
Hey, hey.
Hello, guys. We're back.
It's been a long time, it seems like. At least seems like to me.
I agree. We stopped before the holidays. I think right before Thanksgiving.
Yeah, maybe. I can't remember, honestly. I mean, it's now towards the end of February. It's a few days away from the end of February, and I can't even remember. It's got to be before the new year, before the unholy trinity. All three of us have congregated to silent film podcast. So it's been a while. So it's good to hear you guys. Good to reconvene for what is, I think, one of the final times of this podcast. I will get into the details about this. I know I said that last time too, but I kind of want to just shuffle it towards the end. And that way we don't have to explain stuff and then have to get into the episode, you know? So we'll push it off towards the end. And for the last time, what we're going to do on this podcast is to watch movie and talk about it. And this week, for the last time, we're going to watch, we have already seen Metropolis, 1927, directed by Fritz Lang. And we're going to talk about it. And before we get there, just a real quick kind of overview of what we've been watching. So Lily, you said you watch a bunch of stuff. So why don't you go first?
Okay, so for the contemporary area, or time period, excuse me, I did finally get, I found online The Man Who Laughs with Conrad Veidt. My paper's not in here. I believe it's 1928. That is such a heart-wrenching feature. Like, I was not expecting it. They call it a silent horror in respect, but it really is a gripping movie, and it's so, like, more sad than you would expect it to be. Because we've talked about this film on the podcast before. The Joker from modern day Batman is based on this character as well. And you think it's supposed to be more gritty and horrifying, which, I mean, it is, but I was more surprised.
Well, the comic book was based on him. Like, the original DC comic book character was inspired, I think, partly by...
Yes. This, oh, definitely.
And then, of course, the movies came after the comic books, right? So.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so it's... I don't know. I don't have any notes on it, of course, because I'm just talking about it, but it's a very good film. Just more emotional... twisting than you would think at first sight. And then I also watched The Artist, which is a 2011 film. Yes, they had it on Netflix, so I was like, I would like to see a modern day silent film. And it was kind of funny because Yifang, I know you saw my Facebook story about there was a certain part in the movie, and I'm just like, this is boring. It got better after that, but
wow.
Yeah, I don't know. For like the modern day silent film, I didn't know what I expected, but it is a good movie.
What was the name of the first movie?
The Man Who Laughs, 1928.
The Man Who Laughs. Okay.
Other than Metropolis, I started watching The Toll of the Sea with Anna May Wong. I did not, that is a film I did not finish because my internet kept acting up because my computer crashed at one point and then I never got back to it. So, using my new laptop as we speak. But I would like to finish that movie because Diane talked about it in one of our previous podcasts as well, and I've been dying to see it. So, those are my movies. How about you guys?
Well, just today I watched State of the Union, which is a Tracy and Hepburn film by Frank Capra.
And oh, Capra's amazing. I mean, he's always amazing.
He's one of my favorite directors for sure.
Right.
And it co-stars Van Johnson and Angela Lansbury. And, Frank Capra is always political, and it's about a man basically railroaded, connived into... running for president and his relationship with his wife. So the cute thing about the movie is State of the Union is a dual. The title refers to State of the Union being that he's running for president, but his union with his wife at the same time. So I like it. I like that movie a lot. So
Harold Lloyd, YouTube, if you go on YouTube channel and you search for Harold Lloyd's official estate-approved, maybe not approved, but Harold Lloyd movies. He has a YouTube channel that's pushing out like pretty unique. Search for the channel called Harold Lloyd.
Okay.
Okay.
And the YouTube channel, and you subscribe to it. It's publishing both full films as well as shorts of the Harold Lloyd's sort of his oeuvre of his entire filmography, not the whole thing, but a big chunk of it. I don't know if it is the whole thing, actually. I haven't really looked, but it's a big chunk of things that are largely unseen. And it's legitimate, too, because there's going around the circles in the silent film private fan communities. And it's really significant. I mean, some of it's in HD, full HD, 1080. Some of it is
on YouTube. I'm surprised.
Yeah. And also like never been seen. And it's just really, you know, Harold Lloyd's now, because we did a review on Safety last and it was an incredible movie. I really liked it a lot. Mm-hmm. To me, it was almost basically like a perfect comedy, you know? And so having access now, because that's the problem with his stuff, right? He held it so close to his chest that he died without really giving it to a trustee or some group of people that would care for his films, you know what I mean? And basically after his widow wife died, it basically got sold off in different places, different people and entities and organizations owned the rights to his films, you know what I mean? And so that's why it's really hard to get a hold of Harold Lloyd movies, because he really wanted it to be shown in the movie theaters. And in the 40s and 50s and 60s, when a lot of the cinema tried to play his movies, some of the TV studios, like when television first started arriving, television wanted to get the rights of his films to be, you know, played on TV, right? On reruns and whatever. And he refused. He really just wanted it to be in the cinemas, right?
Right. I can see there's some pushback.
Well, because he didn't want to play the game. He was just like, this deserves to be on the big screen. Mm-hmm. And that was his quality control. But unfortunately, he died before, you know, all of this modern, you know, streaming stuff we have these days. You know what I mean? So anyway, long story short, it's incredible array of stuff in there, some of which has basically never been seen or very rarely seen. How about that? So check it out. It's a bunch of stuff. I'm just looking at this real short list here. Kid Brother, full film, Safety Last, The Freshman, Speedy, and Under the Shorts, Now or Never, From Hand to Mouth, Among Those Presents, Bumping to Broadway. Some of these are some of the largest, most popular things in pristine, as pristine as you can. Anyways, check it out. He's definitely one of the greats, you know, right up there with the Chaplins, the Buster Keatons, except that both of those other artists have had their filmography basically out and about, accessible. How about that? If you were looking for it, you can access it. But Harold Lloyd for a very long time has not been, you couldn't access it. And so literally just dropped some of this a month ago, some of this 4 or 5 days ago, some of it's just 11 hours ago. Yeah, like Now or Never just got published 11 hours ago. So these are rare treasures, I think, for the new generation. I highly recommend. I think I saw some of this. I can't remember now. But
I know I saw The Freshman was on there. I think I actually saved it to my list because he's supposed to be a football player.
Yeah, go in the channel, subscribe to it, and just check out all this stuff that is being pushed out. It's quite amazing. And there's a full documentary on there, and there's a tracing the footsteps of for his filming of Speedy and on. There's a bunch of stuff on here. It's really cool. As is related to silent film, so.
And I will be linking that in the show notes once I subscribe myself.
Yes. I've also been kind of going through my Kurosawa, which is if not my favorite director of all time. He is, I think I was watching his filmography up until, I want to say, I can't remember, something like either Seven Samurai or before that. I'm kind of going through his filmography one by one, and I stopped somewhere in the middle somewhere, and I can't remember now which one. I want to pick that back up and kind of take it home to completion. So
How did
that's
you
on
like
my
Seven
list.
Samurai?
I mean, I've seen it many times before. It's one of my favorites of all times. I mean, it's got
I love it
everything.
too, yeah.
It's nearly 4 hours long, so it's super long.
Yeah,
But
but
if you
it's a
really,
samurai flick.
well, it's not just that. I think it's a drama about sort of group of people coming together. And the thing about that movie that's it's so fascinating is that Kurosawa himself was a fan of Westerns. So he was inspired by John Ford in the Westerns. That's one of the reasons he made his own version of it in a kind of Japanese style samurai take of a Western, which, of course, if you know film history, then Magnificent Seven was inspired by Seven Samurai, which, of course, now remade recently, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years. But
Which I still
anyways.
haven't seen because I just don't have the courage. Because it's my favorite film of all time.
You're talking about Magnificent Seven, or you're talking about Seven
Yeah, that's
Samurai?
Magnificent Seven is my favorite movie of all time.
Oh, really? Like,
And
you mean the
then
Western that was inspired by
the
Seven
Western.
Samurai?
Oh, yeah, it's John Sturges. Yeah. But I don't know how much I'm going to hate the new one with
Oh, yeah, just
Denzel
skip it, right?
Washington.
Yeah, just skip it altogether. I would say then I munched a little bit on It's a Wonderful Life as well. I have the 4K disc version, and I guess on a whim, played it. And it's like you said, Bob, for State of the Union. I hadn't seen that movie. I haven't seen a lot of Capra stuff, but wait, is this that Capra? Let me think.
It is Capra. Yep.
Right? It's a Wonderful Life, right? I'm not getting it
Yep.
wrong.
It's a
I don't
Wonderful
always remember the
Life.
details.
Mr. Deeds goes to town. Mr.
Exactly,
Smith
yeah.
goes to Washington.
And him and Stewart really had a good pairing, had a good run there. So,
Yep. Well, Stewart worked with the Master of Suspense as well.
oh yeah, I mean he worked with a lot of people, but
Yeah.
his
But I mean,
contributions with Capra were really,
great.
yeah, like you said, it wasn't just about one thing. It was like about a whole slew of things, right? It was about the relationships. It was about like, especially like It's a Wonderful Life. The parts I saw was about the small town banking and economics and class. I just found that incredibly fascinating that it's just inherently political, and also just it talked about a variety of topics rather than just a few things. It was really broad, the topics are covered. Anyway, I like that movie.
Which one did you see?
Oh, It's a Wonderful Life. I saw a bits and
Oh,
pieces of
it's, yeah. That's a classic. I have to watch that every Christmas Eve.
Yeah, it used to be on TV on Thanksgiving. I don't know if it
Oh
still
boy.
is, but
I also would recommend if you haven't seen You Can't Take It With You.
I may have
I've
seen
read the
that.
play.
I've either seen that or I've seen You Can't You Only Live Once. I always get those two titles confused. There's a bunch of movies in the black and white days of You Can't Something With You. So I always get a number of those titles confused, but I've seen a number of those. You Only Live Once also is a good movie too. I think that's also by Fritz Lang, pretty sure. You Can't Take It You Film. Let me double check. Could be wrong. Can't take it with you. Oh, actually, this is by
Oh
Capra.
wow, go
I was
figure.
suggesting it. No,
That's why
no,
I
that's
was
the one you
suggesting
just
it.
said. That's the one you just said. Okay, let me see. I was thinking about wait, You Only Live Once. That's what I was thinking about. Okay, so this one's by Fritz Lang. Okay, so You Only Live Once, 1937. That's funny. The one you suggested was the one I was searching for. I get easily confused. So what I was thinking, my brain, what I was thinking about, you only live once, right? Nowadays people use YOLO, but it's 1937. It's directed by Fritz Lang. Sylvia Sidney, Henry Fonda. It's considered an early noir. That's why I think like Fritz Lang is the father of noir, because it really is a lot of the elements of his early film, including Metropolis, has so much of like the nitty-gritty darkness, femme fatale, predecessors. It's kind of prototypical, like a prototype of noir before noir was even constitute as a genre, you know what I mean? But anyway, so it's an incredible movie, that one. You Only Live Once. Really, a lot of the Fritz Lang's Hollywood efforts are really worth watching. But anyways.
That brings us around to Metropolis.
Exactly.
It does indeed.
It does indeed. That's probably all I've seen. I could go on, but that's probably good enough. So let's get into it. I'm going to give you some backgrounds about Metropolis, and then actually, before I get there, what do you guys know of Metropolis before you've seen the movie? I mean, you've seen it before, right, Bob?
I had seen it before, and mostly I didn't remember the details of the story. I only remembered the visuals and the class struggle. You know, I saw it when I was pretty young, probably in my 20s or 30s, sorry if I'm
so many years ago. Many young. Years ago, right?
Sorry, I'm laughing, because I just called someone in their 30s young, and that, some people might like, not even 30s yet.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yep.
I actually really lost my thought, but yeah. Yeah, that's all I basically remember is the visuals, the artistry of it, and I liked it a lot when I saw it the first time. But this time I watched it, I paid more attention to the storyline, and it's got much more to it than I thought.
Hmm. Well, there's actually a lot more film to it than you watched originally, anyways. There's about 30 more minutes on this cut.
Yeah, it's 2.5 hours. Yeah.
Yeah. And Lily, have you encountered this movie before, or at least what are your impressions of what you've heard about this movie before you watched it? Is this the first time you've seen it, by the way?
It is. So I'm not 100% sure if I ever heard about it before we started this podcast. I had seen the posters for it just, you know, on the internet with the robot.
They're kind of iconic, aren't they?
Yeah, it's very unique. You know, you wonder what it's supposed to be about, because what I expected the film to be about wasn't what the poster told me. If you know what I mean? Because most of them are just like a cityscape with just the robot face in the center. And you're just like, okay, what's going on? But, you know, the makeup for it's like insanely creepy, especially. So you're like, what is this movie? I don't think I've heard of it before, but I was I found this great article from Roger Ebert on his website about Metropolis, and there just so many movies were inspired by this film. It's pretty crazy, and I have seen some of them, just some. But they mentioned Blade Runner, The Fifth Element, Bride of Frankenstein, Doctor Strangelove. Like, just so many things can be, you know, pieced back to this one movie from the 20s.
Yeah.
Well, sure. Absolutely. So like Star many. Wars, The Matrix. It goes on and on mm-hmm. and on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. So I'm going to give you guys some background about it. Not too long, but just a little bit. The film is 1927, Metropolis. It's a German expressionistic science fiction drama directed by Fritz Lang. Fritz Lang, for those who aren't familiar, in the sound, I can't remember if we've. I did look at the filmography for Fritz Lang, and I gotta imagine I don't think we reviewed any of it, which is shocking because he's one of the greatest directors, really, of all time. But he's directed some really significant silent films of all time, and I'm just shocked that we hadn't really dove into any of it.
There's but plenty that's okay. more to watch.
Yeah, there's always an endless amount of the things to watch. But he's prior to Metropolis, he started working around mid-1915-16s as primarily a writer of ideas and scenarist. But then he got into directing in 1918 with Halblet and on. But his most popular one is... The one that he gets started to get noticed for, I would say, is like the Spider series. And also there's like their Spiders Part 1, Part 2, The Golden Sea, The Diamond Ship, and then The Wandering Image. Destiny is then he really came into his own with Destiny and Dr. Mabuse, the gambler. It's huge characters, iconic. Dr. Mabuse basically started to become a kind of like a iconic character of noir slash dark German expressionistic cinema from that time forward. I think his last film was also that he directed. It was called The Thousand Eyes of Dr. Mabuse. His very last film was about Dr. Mabuse still after all those years. There's that. And then he also did I'm not gonna do the name justice, Nibelungen. Kind of the mythic, kind of the Lord of the Rings, predecessor to Lord of the Rings mythology, essentially. In two parts. So he got really famous with all of those titles I just mentioned. And that's before he started Metropolis. So he's already a well-known entity in the German film industry as well as world cinema. And so that's just his career. And he got inspired to do Metropolis when he visited New York. And he saw this giant, if anybody's ever been to New York City and you just kind of take a stroll down or any large metropolis, really, city, modern city, it can get really overwhelming if you've never been into a large city. I don't consider Boston a really large city because you can walk through it in like half an hour downtown.
The claustrophobia of two giant buildings being, you're being sandwiched by two giant walls.
Basically. But if you've been to like New York City, that's why they call it the urban jungle, because once you walk through it, it's an endless building after, skyscraper after skyscraper. You could literally walk hours, if not days on end. I don't even know how long. It would almost be near impossible to walk through the entire city on foot. You would be dead tired. It's that large, and it's just like man-made structure. You could walk through the entire city and still be like exhausted, and not exhaust the city. And that's the, I think, the feeling that he got. And even when he was visiting New York City in the 1920s. Probably like 1924, 1925, maybe something like that. I mean, back then it wasn't built up. I don't even know if was Empire State Building even up. I don't even know. But regardless, like
I don't know.
even then there was a huge amount of buildings, and even then it felt overwhelming. I can't even imagine if he were alive today, that if he walked through a modern metropolis, what he would feel like. But you imagine though, you're coming from essentially, a place that doesn't have that. Cityscape, a densely populated city with huge man-made structures like that. And I think so as he was walking through, that's where he got the idea of like, wow, what happened here? Like this, mega structure. And he started that really piqued his interest on creating a film about a massive city and what would happen with the class and who works up there, who works down there. And he started adding more ideas into his. But really, what's amazing isn't just him. What's amazing is that his then wife, Thea von Harbou, was an amazing talent. I mean, if you again think about, the modern representation of, male, female sort of artists in at least mainstream entertainment industry, it's still, on the director front, behind the camera, it was still largely male dominated, right? But back then, as we already discussed several times, pre-1920s was half and half, if not more, that the females were really in power with a lot of things. And in this situation, in that time and space, Fritz Lang's wife, Thea von Bort, was just an amazing artist. This is prior to her own what marriage to Fritz Lang. She already had her own career of screenwriting, directing, and even acting. So she's been in a number of things, but she wrote a lot of stuff. Some with Fritz Lang, some with other people, and so she's done the stuff like he worked with F.W. Murnau in some of his films, worked with Carl Dreyer, worked with all these artists. Came up with some of the ideas for Dr. Mabuse and on and on. So a lot of this concept for Metropolis also came from her, right? So they worked together to come up with the scenario and story for Metropolis. You know what I mean? So that's fascinating too, that it wasn't just a guy who came up with a science fiction story, one of the best science fiction stories and films of all time. It was really the idea and concept and fleshing out of it came from her, you know? She would often write a novel of the screenplay that she just worked on, except for this one. She didn't write the novel for this particular movie. But I mean, think about it. How great of a writer you have to be that you just, I think I'll just turn this into a novel too. And she would often time the novel to get published at the same time when the movie comes out, you know? So she's that talented, you know? So very well-known entities, basically kind of the royalties of German expressionistic film industry as it comes into the making of this film. And that's kind of a little bit background on the artists who are creating this. Obviously, there's a lot more, like the set designers and various different people and effects. And, you know, obviously it takes a team. It's not just one person. But however, and the stars and all that good stuff. And this is, of course, produced in the famous UFA, which is the Universal Film. It's kind of the German film industry's primary studio, you know, that's been turning out many film, great films, pre-Nazi Germany, basically. And so that's kind of, that brings us to the making of the film itself. And, of course, it took, you know, filming takes place from 1925 to 26, over 17 months at this amazing cost. It's one of the most expensive endeavors of all time. So, so it's about, what did they convert it to? 38 million in 2017 dollars. For then is a long, is a lot of money, you know. Because a lot of films back then didn't require this amount of money. But you saw it on screen, you know. A lot of the effects and a lot of the things were very much on the screen itself. When it first came out, it was really mixed. Even an amazed, very famous science fiction author like H.G. Wells described it as silly.
I read that article too. He was like, "What?" Because he compared it to one of his books that had been written a few years before. Right. I didn't write down which book it was, but he was just like, "What the heck?"
Of course, he's biased because he did write some of the best science fiction of all time. Mm-hmm. So, if compared to what he's written, and he's tasted, you know, it's not going to compare, but that's the books, you know. Some of those artists don't understand the film medium as well, you know, as a new medium. Remember, this is still pretty new. It's only two decades or so or less. So anyways, the cut of the movie, after it debuted in just German premiere, a large portion of the original Fritzlein's original footage was removed. And the reason is because it was just so long, and it, due to the criticism, the mixed criticism it came in, it's just like, you know, they really wanted to chop it down for marketing purposes so it can sell better. And there's been many attempts since that time, even by the 70s and 80s, to try to restore it. And there's a long history of that, which I'm not going to go into here. You can read about it in the Wikipedia. But I just wanted to bring you to the latest, the final restoration that we're aware of today, currently. So based on all that they understand, that the notes that they have, there's roughly something like 153 minutes, the original runtime. The cut that has been available to most audiences is either there's been a 90-minute cut, and then in around the year 2000, there's been a two-hour cut, you know, 120-something minute cut. So that's been sort of mainstay of how you can watch and access Metropolis and experience it for a really long time, both since the 1980s, the 90-minute version roughly, as well as the 2001 edit, that it was about 2 hours or 224 minutes long. Now, in 2008 in Argentina, there is a museum that... had a backup copy of, because they make a backup print in case the original, you know, is gone in a fire or something like that. So that's what happened was
Buenos Aires, they found it.
yeah, exactly, in the what's called a Museo del Cine, and the negative is a just a backup copy, right? As I was saying, of the 35mm original. And distributor was just to make sure it doesn't, like, the nitrate doesn't flame, it's, as we know, it's very flammable. So just to make sure that it doesn't explode and catch fire. So they have a backup print in 16mm of the original, maybe not the original 153-minute cut, but as much of it as possible, I think. And so when they discovered it, the print was investigated by this, I guess, a collector, film historian, TV personality, Fernando Pena, and also Paula Felix Didier, the head of the museum. Both of them basically was like, wow, this is incredible. Like, they found this stuff, and then working with the Germans, FWMS, the entity that restores films, the classic German films, they basically restored it back. And along with, they also found additional prints in 05 of missing scenes. Anyways, the long and net sum of it is that they restored it in 2010, and it premiered in February 2010 in Berlin and other places. So that's kind of the that's how we're getting the 148-minute cut, which is nearly 2.5. It's not full 153 minutes. There's about 7 minutes still missing, but probably footage just beyond repair or just different things that where you
When was
can't get.
this last, when was the version we watched released?
The version we watched, it was released in 2010. So that's
Gotcha.
the final complete Metropolis, as complete as you can get, basically. And that one's 148 minutes. That's why it's 2.5 hours long.
Gotcha.
So that's the history of basically bringing up to speed on the print that we watched, which was released everywhere as Kino and everywhere. Master of Cinema, Eureka Entertainment Distributor, and it's everywhere. What was interesting to me was that I around that same time when this all this stuff was happening, about a year later, maybe in 2011, they released one locally here in Boston at the Coolidge Corner Cinema. They had a film print, but they also had Alloy Orchestra, which is like a silent film accompaniment orchestra, and they wrote an original score for it. So they decided for this showing, they didn't want to go with the original film score, but they just like wrote all original. And they've been doing it for a long time, but certainly Metropolis is huge for them. They really liked it, right? And so they wrote an original score. It's a modern take, right? They're modern artists. They used to be in like 80s, 90s bands, and they use their artistry to create a modern score for this movie. And that's kind of what they do, I think. They go around the country touring and do film accompaniments, minutes of original scores that they wrote in current time, modern times, using modern stuff for those silent films. But this is one of the movies that they've been doing. But I was there live. I saw them perform live in Brookline. They're based out of Brookline, anyways, which is where Coolidge Corner Theater is. So between the complete cut and between the original film score, I was like blown away, right? It's an experience. I really wished we were almost going to see it about a year ago in April, because they were going to do another showing of Metropolis with them, the Alloy Orchestra, because they're local, right? They're going to actually perform Beverly, but unfortunately the pandemic got to us.
Oh,
Sad
it's
day.
still
Sad
here.
day. Yeah. So maybe one day, post-pandemic, when it's around, I'll send you guys a notification. If it ever comes back, you should really experience this in person. It's really amazing. It's like a concert feeling. Anyways, so that really made an impression on me. I really enjoyed it, and that's why I've been saying all along that silent films really are like concerts. It's so hard to watch it at home with a non-live orchestra to perform it, you know. And also on a large screen, of course. And anyways, so that brings us to today. One of my favorite films, certainly of all time, regardless of silent, its contribution to cinema is, tremendous and gigantic. And obviously, we just talked about is that Roger Ebert article and all the things we talked about before, highly influential across many other subsequent films. And just, you know, inspirational, right? On many, many fronts. Having given all of that background, let's go with Lily. What'd you think then? Now that you've seen it with the that score, by the way, was the Owl Orchestra score. And by,
oh, one really? Huh.
Yeah. So one more last note is that originally that score was supposed to be included in the Kino like Blu-ray or DVD release, but at the last minute decided to pull funding for it because they really wanted to go with the original. I don't know if the Fritz Lang estate was still on. I don't know if they have power, but whatever the decision was, they were like, we're just going to do the original score. We're not going to use this modern take because they want to be more conservative. They want to like make film fans mad. I think a lot of silent film artists, silent film fans, they really like the original scores. They prefer that, I think, generally. So that's why they pulled this out at the last minute and didn't belong. It's not part of any home release, but you can buy it. That's what I did. I bought the MP3 because that's how they sell it. On a CD. So you can still buy it today. Just search for Owl Orchestra. You can buy the complete score. You just have to kind of sync it up yourself, you know, play it at the right time, which is a little bit tricky. But what'd you think?
Oh, well, knowing that, that's very interesting because I thought it was funny at the very, you know, listening to the score, the music to me reminded me of the game, The Legend of Zelda. I've never really played it, but when I was in college, my roommates would play it, like the original game with like with 2D animation. It was just, the music was just, that's what it reminded me of. So knowing that the Fritz Lang, you know, the community wanted to keep the score original, I would love to hear what the LA Orchestra had it go. It wasn't terrible music, don't get me wrong, but I was just, I had already assumed like it was remade, and knowing that is original just to me is kind of funky. But at the same time, the whole movie is so funky. I was just writing, you know, thinking of what I want to say on Anchor for this film. You know, it's a tantalizing sci-fi wonder. You know, it's got incredible choreography and it just wanders throughout this whole thing, and it's just such a spectacle. It's, you know, I was thinking to myself while watching it, I did take a nap in between because I wasn't feeling too good. But even though it's 2.5 hours, if I wasn't feeling so tired at the time, I probably would have sat through the whole thing and not complained at all. You know, it didn't feel super long, even though it was long. At some points it did, you know, but it's just such a crazy movie to, you know, from not knowing what it was originally about and actually experiencing it, I'm just like, oh my god, this is like, has so much, there's so much to it, you know, just, you know, character I guess you could say there's some character development, maybe there's not, honestly there is with Fredder the lead, but I was like losing it with Maria's the actress Brigitte Helm, just between her going from her gentle, safe self to being so erratic as the fembot, as I wrote in my notes. That was just such good acting. Like, you know, it's the same person, but I'm thinking to myself, holy cow.
Yep.
Just such a striking difference. And I think it made the film even more just that much captivating. There's a lot to say about Metropolis. Hands down, I'd watch it again. If I can go with you guys next year, I will definitely watch it again with the live orchestra.
Yeah, she was only 18, by the way.
She was 18? Oh my god.
Yeah.
I'm freaking out. I'm freaking out over here. Oh man. Yeah, it was just, I mean, you knew she was young because even at the first time they introduce her to the character, oh, I was dying over the clarity of her, what did I write? Just like, well, her introduction shot. Just the clarity on her face was so pretty. I was just like, ah! You know, you think of filmmaking now and you get these beautiful shots with lighting and cinematography. That was in black and white and she still looked beautiful. I was like, oh my god! No wonder Fredder was like, ah! But, I did not know that. That's pretty cool. What else can I say about this? I mean, I have a ton of notes that I took from Ebert's list, but you know,
Yeah,
it
why don't we
just
go to
talks
Bob for
about,
now, and we'll kind of circle back. So, Bob, what do you think?
what did you think, Bob?
I liked it. I liked the story quite a bit. I mean, I
What
learned
was
it.
different between this time and the and now many years later that you've seen it?
Well, the first time I didn't get the whole story. I was more intrigued with just the visuals and the basic storyline. I mean, I followed.
Which
I
are
was
still
focused
astonishing,
more.
right?
What?
Which are still astonishing, right? Even today.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Well, at first when I started watching it, I thought this guy, well, like I said, I was focused on the class struggle mostly when I saw it the first time early on in my life. And I thought it showed that artistically very nicely. Maybe when I watched it, I don't think I watched it the first time I saw it. I'm pretty sure I didn't have any English subtitles. So I think I watched it purely as a silent film. I think they had the German, cards, but I couldn't read them, so I didn't worry about it. I just took what I could from the visuals. And I do remember I liked it. I liked the big machine. And when I saw this one, I paid much more attention to the story, the father-son aspect, that he was realizing things about. I mean, I agree with Lily totally that I think that Frater had a real character development in it. His eyes were open to exactly who his father really was, disconcerned about the lower classes. They're where they belong, as he said. And that aspect of the movie is touching to me. It's touching to me that the son does now sees his father in a different light, I guess the music was the hardest thing for me to take, actually. I loved it. I thought it was well done. But it was like 2.5 hours of the same piece, and it was droning. It was kind of numbing my brain after a while. So good piece, but I thought it was overused, almost constantly, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I think they're using the modern sort of John Williams leitmotif concept for like a silent film, which is weird because they didn't really do that as much compared to today. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other than that, the visuals, I mean, I think the most, there were several, of course, very spectacular things, but I remember very awe-inspiring, imagination inspiring. And again, as you watch silent films, you have to put yourself in the eyes of the era. And the cityscape scene where the planes were flying around and the cars were all driving. And I was thinking to myself, this is 1927. Cars aren't actually terribly old at that point. And of course, they had, like you said, the big city. There weren't that many of them, like really big cities. And so to blow that up and to exaggerate it to the point of this is the future, this is where cities are going, it wasn't a huge leap in imagination to see that. But to see it on screen and imagine this is an audience in 1927 seeing this would be like, oh wow, this is a crazy place, with planes flying through the city. Like, I remember that scene being very striking to me. I was like, wow, I like this, and yeah, it does remind me of a lot of more modern films, things like Conspiracy, not no, what was the one with Tom Cruise where
Minority
Minority
Report.
Report.
Yeah.
I thought the cityscape scene in that looked just like it was taken from this, like inspired by this, where the cars would go on rails and. So anyway, all in all, I liked it a lot. I mean, I definitely think it's worth watching.
Yeah.
Well, you
Yeah, I
mentioned.
mean, go ahead, Lily.
Oh man, it's so hard with this not seeing each other part. No, I was just gonna say, like, I agree with you, Bob, with the cars. I mean, I thinking then to now, I was like, how would they know, like, so many? I mean, they wouldn't know, but just having that concept of how many cars are on the road then for the big city, you know, that's exactly how it is on the 405 out in California. It's bumper to bumper.
Exactly.
I don't know. I think just. I'm not saying they saw into the future or anything, but it's neat when movies can take those little details of life and kind of throw them in to see how it might affect, you know, the future. But I don't know. I'm agreeing with your point of like, I thought about that while watching this film. I was like, wow. You know, it's just different. But that's all I wanted to add.
Yeah, imagine if you were watching. See, the thing about the experience is that if you have, and I'm still watching this as big as a 100-inch projector, right? Like a screen, and it's pretty big, but I still remember my screening in, a 25-foot or 50-foot, gigantic screen of the cityscape. You know what I mean? I mean, that's like overwhelming, your entire field of vision is encapsulated. And I think seeing this on the large scale cinema is like it like a modern, action piece, like you would just watch like a Transformers. Not comparing both, I'm just saying the scale and scope of it, right, of the movie, when you can watch it in the theater on such a large scale and size. I think really makes a huge impact, right? Because,
Oh, absolutely. It's the spectacle of it. That's what makes going
yeah,
to the movie so
absolutely.
wonderful.
Yeah,
On the big screen, as they say.
right. And so when you do that, and even my smaller quote unquote scale, 100-inch, it's still like, it's so impressive to watch that cityscape scenes as well as any of the number of the grandeur, of cinema. But the technical, I think, side of this movie is really, I think the primary talent. It's not the only, but I think it's the richest aspect and component of films like this, and what Fritz Lang brings really well to the table, both his films before this one as well as the films afterwards. He's really good in the from a technical perspective, right? Like even movies of that time, it's really hard to find movies where they cut and juxtapose different themes, the concepts of like the higher and the lower levels to represent the classes. But also, like, there are many scenes in here. I can think of one scene where, okay, so remember there's a scene that Bridget Helms' character, when she was trapped by the mad scientist, the doctor, and he was trying to grab her, and she held on to the bars of the ceiling or something, remember? And she was trying to get out, right? She was screaming, and her screams were heard by the Fremer character, right? Right. And so,
Fremmer,
like, so when he heard it, right, the son, and he was walking, of course, he happened to walk by, right? But he heard it, right?
yeah.
Right. So once he heard it, though, do you remember there was one specific shot where his eyeballs were searching for where that sound came from? And then there's a camera angle panning like left and right frantically at the building, right? Of where the mad scientist was. Remember that? There's one specific shot. It's probably very minor, but that's like a film technique that is something like a modern movie would do, but he was doing it in like 1927, which of course, I think we keep forgetting that by then, that's the final 1 or 2 years of silent film era. Like only a few more years, that's it. There's no more. The industry is going to go through this large conversion to largely sound and talkies, right? And this is the final sort of thesis or capstones of films that are going to be released, that by this time it should be pretty mature, and that they've done so many techniques up to that point. So it shouldn't be a surprise, but I still am all the time because of how great those techniques are, and how some of those techniques are still in use today, right? Of like, like when he heard the sound of somebody screaming, the camera would take his point of view, a POV perspective, and say, "Where is she? Where is she?" And the camera would pan left and right and look at the building where that sound was coming from. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like that technique and that technical level literally places yourself inside of the character. You know, of course you have those, I don't even know what they're called. Like their cameras mounted on the actor or the chest, and they're looking at the actor as they're running, right?
Oh, it's a type of steady cam, but it's a it is a specific type of camera. It's not body cam. I think it's what a it's something like that.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. There's so much there's so much more technology today that can put you into the perspective of the characters now. But even then, like they were already doing so much of that in 1927, right? This is astonishing. And so I think the technical sort of wizardry that, you know, Fritz Lang's pictures have is amazing. Or even like when that machine, the heart of the machine or whatever it's called, exploded and all the workers like were thrown out of they were like thrown from the second or third story level, you know?
Yeah. I saw one and, go flying.
Yeah, there was a bunch of people that went flying, and how they did that, just like one little scene, just a few seconds.
Must have been on ropes because the arms and legs were moving, and they were actual guys. So
I was like, right, or some of the plates were probably overexposed or something. Like they're melted one on top of the other, you know? They're dissolved one to another. It seemed like there was a shadow of a person just, you know, totally not in the same frame or same footage, you know what I mean? And of course it turns into Moloch, right? I love that there's some imagery. See, it's not, you know, as you were saying, Bob, the themes of class is certainly very strong, right? In one aspect of this film, but then above and beyond that, he seems to be imbuing this with so much more than just class. I think there are these father and son stories, but also there's this religious element. There's also a little bit of this religious element of like,
absolutely.
The heart of the machine, right, is Moloch, right? Moloch being, of course, one of the ancient pagan gods where you worship him. It's human sacrifice. You throw humans into fire, burn them as an act of worship, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And there's a literal scene in here. And the literal scene of like the machine turning into the mouth of Moloch with the two.
That was, Frater's vision of it is he saw it as a machine.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's like it wasn't implicit and nor was it like subtle at all, right? It was like blowing your head over with it. Also later on, of course, the Tower of Babel, right? And the biblical notion of it. Of course, you know, it does strip out the God element. I think it's strictly from a humanistic perspective. Because if you look at the scriptures quoting, it's just taking like the specific man and what man is. It actually doesn't go into the place of like compared to what the whole point of the scripture, which is like, oh well, you know, they'll become godlike, you know, if they try to build this, meaning like they're trying to be gods themselves, right? It doesn't really quite go to that level. It just says man, when he's kind of full of himself, his pride will kind of get in the way of his own successes and failures and stuff like that, you know. It's a very limited, filtered humanistic view, right? It doesn't actually go all the way there, you know what I mean? And even in the Revelation 17 quote, when they discuss the horror of Babylon, there's a scene towards the end where the robot's dancing like crazy, right? Stirring the man into lust and stuff like that. Well, that's like it's the same imagery of the horror of Babylon, which they quoted from when they're in the was it the catacomb or was it somewhere else? I can't remember which part now, but
I know it kind of did blend together.
Yeah. But what I'm talking about. So they do reference sort of the Whore of Babylon, right? In Revelation times, and how like that's supposed to, you know, sort of make people, I don't know. I think there's a link between like the technology of the robot and that religious callback into the apocalyptic. Like
it's a corrupting factor in society.
Exactly. Yeah. So class is one element, but I think it leads into a larger discussion of like the apocalyptic nature of the society if some of these injustices of class struggles are not dealt with. It can lead to apocalyptic mm-hmm. end of the world scenarios. I think that's what it's, you know, I think detailing, right? He's imbuing with it, not just like, okay, on the surface, there's this, obviously, this literal high class where he's in the clouds, literally living in the clouds, right? And then also the class is underneath the ground, sort of working to help make the people above happy, you know, basically the workers, you know. So there's that one element. But when there's an imbalance, of course, the whole theme of the movie is what? The mind and the heart or something?
The hand connects the heart, or the hand, the eye, no, the hand and the head and the heart.
The head and the hand need to be connected by the heart.
By the heart, right.
And they were like, sappy.
Yeah. But I think the notion is this, that if the hand, which is the worker, and the head, which is the manager, is up top, if they're not in balance, then it's going to cause apocalyptic things to happen, right? Mm-hmm. That's why the water is flooding, and that's why there's it, like, the whole thing is collapsed and destroyed, you know?
Yeah.
When there's an imbalance, right?
Yeah.
So I think those are some of the additional themes above and beyond just like a simple class struggle. There's also those elements of like, when those things are imbalanced, and of course, you know, you got the whole like children is caught in between and all that stuff. There's more drama behind it. What do you guys think of? There's a character in here called the Thin Man. Have you heard of this before?
I loved him. I loved him.
Now, you know that there's another work of Hamel or something, Hammett, I forgot his name. He wrote a novel and eventually a movie called The Thin Man. There's a movie series in 1934.
Right, The Thin Man, yeah.
Right, it's unrelated to this Thin Man, right?
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, that one is more of a detective or something like that, right? Eventually.
Right, they're unrelated, right?
They are unrelated, but I love how the notion.
Okay.
But I love how the notion of that character is in here. Now, I don't know for sure because I wasn't there, and I don't, in my Googling, it doesn't seem like there is a connection. But I'm just wondering out loud if there is, because if this movie came out and it's super popular, you wonder if that author was thinking at least about like the Thin Man, right?
There's no similarity at all between the two characters. So
there isn't. No, I understand that there isn't. But the notion that the Thin Man is like a detective like character. He's following the sun, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Right. So there's an element of a dark sort of noirish thing. That's why I said Fritz Lang is the grandfather of noir, because even in such a small little area, it potentially could be inspiring that. But anyway, that's a little side note. But I love that character in this movie, though. He's very...
I did too. He was very vampire-ish.
Yeah. He's like something that moves hits against an immovable force, you know? Like, he's just like... You know, you can't move him. You can't touch him, you know?
Yeah.
He's something
as the stuff. Guy in the car couldn't break his grip.
You know? Yeah, exactly. He reminds me a little bit like the concept of the Joker, right? Meaning in the sense that he's just a force of nature. Yeah, he's a concept. He's not even like a real person.
Exactly. But he's sinister and he's great. The guy's like, get out, I'll tell you up. And he sits casually sits down.
He's
just
like, yeah, whatever. I'm gonna do my thing.
Yeah. No, I liked him a lot. I thought he was great. Yeah. Fritz Rasp is the actor's name.
Yeah. What did you guys think of the John Fritter's wife, or well, I guess his widow, the deceased wife, and the son's mother? Like, what do you know what the behind the what? Story behind him? Or her, rather, in the Mad Scientist.
I didn't even realize that part of the movie at all.
So yeah, she basically has been immortalized. You know, there's a giant head of Hel, H-E-L.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So that was the dead wife's name. Now, the backstory, and this is right. I only know this because I read it, but It doesn't really explicitly spell out in the film, but essentially what happened was the mad scientist guy, right? The guy who created the robot, he is in love with the woman who ran away and got married with John Fritter. So he's always been jealous and didn't like John Fritter, the father guy, right?
That's why he brought on to bring them both down.
Yeah, and that's why he said, like, that's why he said this, like, when he opened the curtain and there's a statue basically to HEL, right? That's the wife. That's the there's a the
that food did on not there. Come and that's why he said clearly.
Yeah, and that's why he said what did she say? She said, this is mine. Like, don't take it away from me, because that shrine or that concept of and the mother died giving birth to the son, right? And so there's father and son tension right there, right? But anyway, long story short is that the mad scientist was in love with her, and she ran away to be with him. And of course, now the mad scientist is like jealous, is like, hey, looking behind the curtain is mine. Like, you've already taken her away in real life. Don't take her image of her away from me, you know what I mean?
Right.
No, that way. You know, scientist guy. Yeah.
I wanted to back up a little bit on my previous comment about how much I liked the father-son aspect of the film, but I didn't really explain for the sake of our listeners that the father, Johann, is the designer of the city itself, right? And all the machines and laborers below the city basically work in fear of this man. And then the son, you know, who makes the discovery of these workers and confronts his father and finds that his father's very cold towards them and says, well, they're where they belong. I just wanted to explain that for the listeners for their sake, that this relationship for me is very central to the movie.
Well, I think explaining that piece that you're just explaining, I think explain some of that relationship, because if you think about it, you know, the fact that she died giving birth to him, his son, I mean, obviously he would love his son, but also there's this coldness from the father to the son, because it's like, you caused my wife to die.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
The beginning of the movie is very cold, very stoic.
Right. So I think some of that, not all of it, but I think there's an element of that that comes from that background story, which is, I think, is the reason why I wanted to explain it more, so people understand as they're watching the movie that that's why there's some coldness in there, because it's that whole background story of, you know, she died giving birth to the child. Yeah.
I wish they had explained that a little more clearly and a little less artistically. Because you think, what is hell? Hell seems like this mythical satanic god, you know, like, what is this, you know?
Well, I mean, it is in the plaque, though. It's if you read the, you know, that big head, giant head, it says, hell, born to bring me happiness and a benediction to all mankind, which is the mad scientist's sort of homage to her, because he loves her, right?
Yeah.
But then it says, lost to John Fredersen, which is the architect guy, died giving life to Fritter.
It was like incredibly detailed to be like, this is the reason why. It's just like,
yeah,
dude, get over it. Yeah.
Yeah. It is John Fritter's son. Yeah, you don't. Yeah. Yeah. You might not.
So that part, we know is the life.
By me.
Yeah. But it doesn't, it still doesn't explain there. It doesn't explicitly tell you that he loves her. You just have to read into the fact that This mad scientist built an altar to her, essentially, with a large head, right?
Rotwang. So, I don't know how you say his name. Rotwang?
Yeah, Rotwang. Yeah. So he built an altar to her and covered the curtain and say, hey, get out of here. This is my stuff. You already took her away. So you have to, like, read into his acting. You really have to read into his silent film acting to get the fact that, you know, there's a huge bitterness between him and that's why I think, when you know how in that section in the cave, in the catacomb rather, and they went down the catacomb to observe Maria talking about the Tower of Babel, but his son's down there at some point, he blocks the hole, remember? he knows that John's son is down there, but he tells John to go up. It's like, hey, you're done here. Go back up in the cave, right? He says, all right, see you later. But he knows, the mad scientist knows that John's son is down there, right? And so he prevents him from seeing his son is down there. And of course, he's going to be like, I'm going to replace this girl, Maria, with a robot so that, she will cause the downfall of the workers and distrust and all that stuff, and his son. But also on another level, the robot, of course, is an image of the wife, right? Or the mother. Now there's an Oedipal complex. Because, of course, John Fred, the son, is in love with the girl, right? But now the girl is replaced by the robot. The robot is an image of the mother. You see how there's an Oedipal complex, right?
Oedipus, yeah.
I do now.
So that's why it's so rich,
Weird.
right? It's a really rich element of the story that isn't always like on the surface, right?
Yes.
And I think the complete cut adds a lot of those additional elements. You guys can tell when the additional footage is added, right? You can tell when the extra footage is in.
Because it was the streaky lines, right?
It's really
Yeah.
scratchy,
Yeah.
really bad quality. That's as good as it gets.
I
So you
see.
can tell when the additional, and they're usually just very character-driven reactions, I think, reactionary shots. They're trying to slim down the time so they can show more of the movie, right? Back in the day, that's why they cut it out.
See. The guy, World Twang, he Twang, I don't know how you say that, but
Got one.
he what is it?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Twang?
I'm just making it up. You just have to sound confident. If you sound
Oh.
confident, that's the way it's pronounced. Rotwang. Yeah, that's
Right on.
it.
I was thinking Rotwang, like,
Sure.
but
Hey,
anyway,
be confident. That's all that matters.
I thought I just wanted to give him kudos for doing a really good mad scientist.
Oh, yeah. Maybe one of the original mad scientists. I didn't even know other mad scientist roles before this. I can't remember. I guess maybe Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Jekyll and Dr. Hyde.
Yeah, that came
Maybe
out a
that's
few
one
years
too.
before this one.
Yeah.
I noticed a classic scene in it, which I thought might be the first time it was seen in a film. I don't know, but the broom of doors, which was used in many other films, where you walk in and you see all these doors and you don't know which one's the right door.
Oh, right, yeah.
And what was interesting is there was a magical quality to the mad scientist's labyrinth because the doors would close behind him with like magically.
Right, I think that it's not just purely scientific. I think there's also a I forgot the word they use often. Mysticism, I think, is the word, but there's a lot of supernatural mysticism. Like, because back then
He had
they
a
used to
pentagram on his door of his house, which
exactly.
tells you a lot.
Right, but not only that, I feel like back in the old times, even around that era and before, the whole notion of like alchemy and magic and science were a one. Like there wasn't a separation now of like, oh, if you believe in like, dark witchery magic that's fake and science is real. I think back in the day, probably earlier than this, but like earlier than the 20s and before that, there's a whole notion where all of that was the same. Like you would go to this quote unquote witch doctor. That's one of the reasons why the name stuck, because it was all the same. Like how you got cured was also how you got the same love potion. Like it was the same person handling magical stuff, because healing was like magical, right? Like that's the whole notion of like science, when it's advanced enough, appears to be magic, right? And I think like even back then, they still stuck to some of that, and that's why that scientist with the door closing, as well as animating that robot, right? There's an
Of
element,
course.
there's a mystic element to that above and beyond the science. Yes, there is some science fiction element, but I think there's a layer of like mysticism in classic science fiction that doesn't really exist in modern science fiction. You know what I mean?
Yes, totally.
So.
I mean, when you see the transformation of the robot into the girl, I mean, it's just like, okay, we're just going to say this happens. You know,
Well, it's
like with
magic.
the
It's
electrodes and everything
magic.
going, like,
Yeah,
it's
it's a
like
lot more
Frankenstein's
magic.
monster
Yeah,
comes
it's
to
a lot more
life.
magic than science fiction, you know? A lot more fantastic and fantasy related, so. In fact, it's similar to Gollum, right? We never reviewed that, but there was a movie called Gollum where they, you know, made a monster out of mud or something, you know?
The Jewish
In that
folklore.
The fable,
scene,
yeah.
I actually wondered, it had me really curious if I didn't know if it was going to go in this direction, but I feared that he was going to take the skin off the girl and put it on the monster. And I was like, ooh, this is getting creepy.
I thought she was
That's
gonna
what
straight up just die because I thought he was putting it
I did
into her,
too.
and then I figured it was still gonna be the robo lady, but it was her. I was like, what? Okay, that's different.
Yeah, that had me in suspense. I thought, oh, she's gonna die, you know? Nope.
Nope, and then they
Just a
just have
copy.
tea and conversations in her dungeon room. I was fr
Yeah.
That's another thing that's like you don't expect her to be in the room sitting with Rotwang, and she's kind of crying over what's been happening to her persona, and I was, you know what I mean? That first initial take where she's there, you're like, wait, she lived? Because
Yeah.
certainly as the viewer, I did not expect her to live because they show her like fainting in the chamber or like
Right, when she's
dying. Who
lying down, they
knows?
show her like her head goes to the side with her eyes closed, and you could,
Yeah,
oh,
like,
she's
oh,
died.
yeah.
she did.
There's another the other element of the fantasism. I think the fantasy or mysticism, I think, has to do with a lot of the visions that the son gets, right? Not just the Moloch vision, but also like when he passes out a lot, first of all, so for some other reason. But when he does, and he sort of comes to when he's on his when he's ill on his bed or something, and he thinks that the thin man is like a priest, right? And that's where the whole Tower of Babel comes in. He basically quotes Revelation 17, you know. And remember, there's a scene where the statues of the church that he was with the death, the scythe, and the seven deadly
Yeah,
sins,
the seven deadly sins,
the
yeah.
statues come alive, and they're, you know. So it's like a vision of the future, right? It's a lot more
Yeah.
fantastic and a lot more mystic, I think,
Yeah.
than just, you know.
You know, one thought was really kind of odd was that the machine man was clearly a woman.
Right.
They kept using that term, and I was like, it wasn't
Well,
even it didn't even look like a man. It looked
I
like a
think
woman.
that might just be more of a translation thing, because it's probably something more like human machine rather than
Man
man,
as
the
in
master and
species,
man,
yeah.
right? Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of thought that, but it was still kind of felt weird. But yeah,
Yeah, it must
it
be.
is coming from German into English, so.
Yeah, that's my guess. Yeah. Yeah, so. I mean, there's. I feel like with this movie, there's almost a limitless amount of things to talk about. You could take one topic and you keep going on and on and on. You took some notes on the article that
Yes.
you wrote
Well,
about.
I didn't exactly take notes, but I did take pieces from what he wrote.
Oh, okay.
Well, he talks, you know, it talks about like how, like, kind of what we were saying about Metropolis itself. You know, Lang's story is broad, to put it mildly, but the storytelling in this film is mostly visual because, you know, everything that's happening, you have these, like you said, big spectacles, like with, the robot Maria and her, you know, doing her lusty dance, and then eventually she becomes like the monster of Babylon from the book, so to say. And just stuff like that. You know, just talking about like he kind of called like the heavenly side of Metropolis like that type of pleasure garden where we first meet Fredder, and then obviously the very bottom, the bowels of hell, where all the workers work, which is you know, everything has its own imagery. Because at one point, you know, we're kind of sinking down with the employees, and I think they're actually all painted on, and then just the background's moving while they're in the elevator shaft. And that alone was
Yep.
like, that was pretty cool for the artsy person and myself. And just like other things that are like, just very big and dramatic. You know, I had obviously having watched the film, you forget things because it is longer. But when the crowd is chasing Maria, like, or even just the chase scene itself in the catacombs where Rotwing's trying to attack her, and you know he just wants her. That I will say, I think he mainly wanted her because Fredder was into her, right? And he's like, "Oh, I'm gonna get you because revenge." I'm assuming now while I'm saying it, yes, that's my answer. But at the
Yeah.
time, like, why is he bothering her? Just leave her alone. I will say they he also mentions like the Tower of Babel, and that's a part of the movie I'd have to watch again because it, you know, talked about making Metropolis, and at first they couldn't, and then they related it to Babel. But I think from someone who learned about that in high school, I don't really remember what that story was about. So I'd have to like, you'd have to know the context to kind of really fully piece it together for the film, if that makes sense. But it just talks about like, you know, the how the actors was. It talked about Lang himself. Apparently, like he was. Could be cruel to the extras, you know, there's hundreds of extras in this film, and you know, they would be like sitting out in the cold for hours or this, that, and the other. Probably they only got paid like $1.50 a day, so whatever the money was back then. And I guess he was like a pretty meticulous, not maybe a slightly harsh director, but I mean, I'm not agreeing to that, but having that type of power gives you a film such as this. And I'm saying that from experience from also working on a film where the director wasn't that nice. But I don't know. I don't know what the final cut is going to look at this movie, so we'll just stop right there. You know what I'm saying? So, it's a good article just to read. Like I said before, I'll link it in the show notes because he talks about the Thin Man as well. Why he's I guess he talked about also why he switched with Georgie, inmate number 11811. You know, just wanting to have see the identity and perspective of the workers. It's that's really kind of it. It's I don't know, I'm not quite summarizing this as much as I'd like, but
That's okay. I mean,
yeah.
you can kind of extract out of the thing that you kind of wanted to highlight, right?
Yeah, but I will say, going back to, you know, those perspectives that he used with his camera, I know you mentioned the one where he's looking for Maria. There was the one where he goes to grab her ripped dress and, you know, we follow his hand. I like that. And the biggest one was like the shaky cam, I called it, or, you know, the swinging camera on a pendulum when the dam, it's not the dam burst, but the water pipes burst in the lower level, and it just they both actors dropped and the camera swung. I don't know, I just thought it was a very cool shot visually, and it just to me it seemed like it heightened the sense of danger and urgency when it happened. So just it's weird little things like that, like the quirks that also make this movie more
Yeah,
appealing.
there was a oh, sorry,
No,
didn't
I'm
mean to
done.
interrupt. There was a in that scene you were talking about, I remember that it was there was a very noirish almost a 45 degree angle shift in the camera angle
Yeah.
in that. I thought that was a very good, I mean, that gave you the feeling of being off balance, like all of a sudden, whoa, sideways, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
That's called a Dutch angle, by the way.
Was it a Dutch angle? Huh.
Yeah, that's a common thing that filmmakers then and now still use to get you an off balance. The what's a very famous Carol Reed film called The Third Man used that quite
Oh, I
extensively
love
with
The
Joseph
Third
Cotten
Man.
because Orson
Oh,
Welles
that is
came out at the
so
end.
amazing.
Yeah, it basically like the story, totally side note, but the story of the film is that you got the American in Europe and nobody speaks English, and he's trying to ascertain what's going on with his friend who was supposedly murdered. And so like it's that's why the camera's off balance, because he can't quite get his grip on what's going on.
Yeah.
And so every camera angle adds to that. If you haven't seen it, Lily, you got it. Yeah. Add it to the list.
Add it to the list.
Add it to the list. Excuse me.
Yeah, oh, it's a must-see movie. No question. It's one of the best noir films ever made.
Yep. There are many. Kind of going back a little bit to the question you have about the context of the Babel. So there are two references to that. So the first thing is the Tower of Babel. Yep. I can't speak of that. Mm-hmm. So that comes from Genesis 11. Now, I'm just pulling this up. Genesis 11 says, "Now all the earth used the same language in the same words, and it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of." This is post. I think it's pre fun. Settle there, and then they said to one another, "No, this is post now. Come, let us make bricks and fire them thoroughly." And they used bricks or stone, and da da da. I keep fast forwarding here. Come. And they said, "Come, let's build ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let's make a name for ourselves, otherwise we'll be scattered abroad over the face of all the earth." And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower with which the men had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language, and this is what they have started to do. Now nothing which they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's speech." The Lord scattered them abroad. They are over the face of all the earth. They stopped building the city. Therefore, it was named Babel. Because the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there, the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. Of course, this passage, right, it's in the Bible, is talking about God and its relationship with people here. But in the actual movie, when it talks, and when Maria, the character, which is in the catacombs, talking to the workers down below, it basically filtered out everything to do with the Lord. Because it's really talking about the city and man building the city, right? And that's the extent of what she's talking about. That's what I was referring to earlier. She didn't talk about God or the Lord at all. She was basically saying, man, when building the city, those elements of, like, the pride is going to destroy whatever, you know. It didn't have to do with the actual passage from the scripture, you know what I mean? Like, it basically filtered the God element out, right?
Right.
Hmm.
That's what I was trying to reference earlier.
But the principle behind why it was brought in, and clearly it's called Babel because it is a concept from the Bible.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic concept behind it is that when a large group is unified, they can do so much more and have so much power. Whereas the leadership, those are ruling class, will intentionally keep a large group that poses a potential threat at odds against different factions within themselves to keep them unaware of their potential. And that, yeah, I felt very strongly in this movie.
Hmm.
Yeah, so
that's why I brought in the Tower of Babel, the story of Babel entirely. So
yeah, and so I'm scrolling through the movie, and in the movie it says, "Today I shall tell you the legend, the construction of the Tower of Babel." I keep saying towel. tower. The construction of the Tower of Babel.
It's quite the shower.
It is quite the difference.
Yeah.
So she recounts it in the catacombs, right? When the workers are going to her after their work schedule shifts, right, and they're tired. And says, "Come, let us build a tower whose zenith shall reach unto the stars," right?
Mm-hmm.
And it goes, I'm just going to read you the intertitles. And at the tower of zenith we shall write, "Great is the world and its maker, and great is man," right? And it shows the tower.
Maybe I did hear the whole story and I just was just thinking it was part of the film.
Yeah. And that was me thinking she was talking to them saying, "You unified have so much power."
Right. But who those who had conceived of the Tower of Babel could not build the Tower of Babel. The task was too great, so they paid wages to outside hands. Right?
Mm.
Sense.
So it's like a you know, it's basically just for the movie, right? It's obviously nothing. It's nothing like the passage right from the Bible I just read, which has to do with God and its people, right? But the hands that built the Tower of Babel knew nothing of the dream, of which the head had conceived it, had been fantasizing, which basically kind of goes to the core of the message of the movie. And it goes Babel, and what does it say? And it keeps showing the hymns and praise of, what does it say? It keeps repeating Babel, and it says the hymns and praise of one man became the curses of others. And it repeats the theme of the same language is spoken, but these men did not understand one another.
The explanation of why they need the mediator.
Yeah. Great is the world's maker and great is man. And then it repeats the theme of even towards the end of the movie, which is
the head and the heart.
Yeah.
The head and the hand.
The head and the hands require a mediator, which is the heart, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thinker the mediator and the head and hands must be the heart.
And that was like the very closing scene in the movie was the father shaking hands with the foreman.
Exactly. Because the son is the heart, right? He's the mediator. He's the heart that links the head, which is the father, and the worker is the son, right? There's a union rep, essentially.
Exactly.
The worker, right? And he's the hand, right? He's the worker.
That's it.
And the son is the mediator, which is the heart. And then the father is the head, right? He's just all head but no heart, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, this is just to explain away some of the Babel imagery that you had questions about, but the son comes out, and then he basically like faints or something, you know, he goes down a lot, and so he's in his bed, right? He's sick or something, he's ill. And his dad's checking on him. But when he wakes up, he has a hallucination or maybe a vision. And that's when the thin man comes to visit him, right? And so in his vision, the thin man becomes like a preacher person with the Bible.
Right. Weird.
Yeah, that's his vision, right? So, and then he quotes from the scripture, "Verily I say unto you, the days of which the apocalypse speaks draws nigh." And he's quoting, of course, from Revelation 17, which I won't do the whole thing, but the relevant passage of it is 1 to 18 or something, saying, "And then came one of the seven angels with seven vials and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will hew unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication." So he carried away and me away, and this me is the author, the John of Revelation, the Apostle John, in the spirit of into the wilderness. "And I saw a woman set upon the scarlet colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads, ten horns, a woman arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious on. The key factor is upon her forehead was a name written: Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abomination of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with blood of the saints and with the blood of martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw, I wondered with great admiration, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are da 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 da." And it goes on. So
that plays a lot into the way Bridget Helm was playing the character when she became the robot. It was really manic and crazy, you know?
Well, the audiences looking at her were saying she represented all seven sins, right? Come to life.
Right. Exactly. Right. Which would probably drive anyone crazy.
Okay. I didn't catch that one part. So glad you brought it up.
In the context of the Bible, when he was talking about that specific passage, so Babylon was an empire in the 400-500 BC, around that time, but about half a millennia before
Yeah, it's like Mesopotamia or something like that.
Yeah, around the those, modern day Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, like all that region near the body of water next to India, I forget what it's called now. But so like that area used to belong to Empire Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar is one of the most famous ones from the Book of Daniel. Long story short, that Babylon, the empire, used to be kind of the be all and end all. Like they rule the known world at that point, right? Basically, like Alexander the Great ruled basically the same places. That whole notion of Babylon basically means it represents, in the in that context of scripture, or Revelation 7, it represents man its greatest pride and height of this the represents the pride height of its pride. Basically, it's like, Babylon represents man being saying, I am God himself, I'm better than God, I don't need God, I am Babylon. That's what Babylon is, representative of that. So in the context of scripture, it's talking about the whore of Babylon. It's the imagery, it's the fact that Babylon, the notion, the concept of Babylon throughout scripture is representative of man, the pride of their own, the sin of pride, of how prideful they are as human, and then like God humbles the pride, right? The people with pride, by bringing everything to a conclusion in the apocalypse, which is why it's in Revelation, right? That's the context of the whore of Babylon. That's the whole concept behind it. Now, evoking that imagery, and even when he woke up, he was like dreaming of reading the Revelation of Saint John, right, by Avalon Publishing. He was reading it, so that's where he fell into a stupor and vision and stuff. So I think that's the tie, the imagery, and this, and the concept, and the context of the tie of scripture in both in the Tower of Babel and the Whore of Babylon. The whole idea is that Babylon represents humanity trying to be great himself, and by trying to be great, they enacted a lot of injustices in the class struggles that they have by having people who are higher up, like CEOs, managers, and they're getting all the benefits in their gardens of delights while the workers down there are like slaving to death, right? Kind of like a little bit of a little bit of, I think, criticism of capitalism a little bit. I think that certainly was in his mind. It's the rise of post-industrial realization, during the era of time, and they could see the effects of manufacturing, industrialization of people working to death, literally in the factories,
Yep.
Does that resonate,
Definitely.
Ron? You think that
Absolutely.
there's some ties? I think that's why he's using some of that religious imagery to
Absolutely.
yeah. But hopefully that's not too off topic. Really. Sorry to answer your
No, it's a
question.
lot of information, but I
Yeah,
mean,
you're trying to you had some
yeah.
questions about that, so I was trying to bring some context to the
No, that's
table.
what you need for the podcast. I mean, we're silent film, so if we don't know what's
Yeah.
going on, there you go.
But I think you find that a lot of sound filmmakers have that background, and I think they do allude to that often in their films. He's not alone, I think, in doing that. A lot of filmmakers frequently reference scripture for some of those purposes. It presupposes some of this context, right? In Sunday school, assuming people were going to Sunday school back then, you know what I mean? So, any parting thoughts? I think that's probably good enough for this particular one. I mean, we could probably spend all night talking about it because it's a really dense movie. And it, like we just talked about, it goes into depth and calls upon and alludes to so many different things, whether it's scripture, whether it's class, whether it's political systems, whether it's science fiction elements, whether it's technology. Oh, and even like we haven't even talked about how technology could corrupt and stuff like that, you know? We haven't even gotten there, you know what I mean? So,
Well,
I.
I think hopefully we gave people a good idea of what the film's about.
Yeah, I think we got them started, hopefully, and you definitely check it out. It's available on Kino on the US side. And I think if you're in the Europe region, there's a Master of Cinema by Eureka Entertainment. They put out similarly good quality products out there. I'm not sure we're streaming because you never know with streaming. You know, there's certain copyrights could be negotiated. It could be here, it could be there. I'm pretty sure it's got to be on, if you're in the right region, the Criterion Channel. Pretty sure it is. I don't have it, so I don't really know. But maybe it's on Canopy. I didn't look for it, but maybe it is. Again, if you're in a region that can access that. But for, I think, non-US, most of the times you just have to get the physical media, because that's really the only way you can enjoy the movies. Anyway. So, any parting thoughts about Metropolis before we wrap it up?
Fritz Lang pulls out all the stops on what critics claim today is a creative masterpiece, and at the time wasn't considered an exact flop, but wasn't as well received, possibly because of the cutting when it left the country. But it's certainly a movie that is represented into today's society, and it can be seen, and it has been used heavily throughout the last, 70 years, almost 100 years of influence. So that's kind of all I have to say. You can't really watch like a sci-fi film today without something harking back to this, and potentially Lang's other work as well, which we should all just check out eventually by ourselves. If he was already such a great director by this point, what was he producing like 2 years prior?
Yeah, I mean, he did that Lord of the Rings like epic right before this, I think. And that was a massive production too. And after this, he did, I think, one, maybe two more silence, probably just one more called A Woman on the Moon. Which is, but that's what it's about, a woman in the moon. But it imagines, space travel. Like, at least they really tried to imagine. It was kind of like a little bit like 2001 Space Odyssey, a little bit of its day. Because if you remember when 2001 Space Odyssey came out, it gave people a vision of the future of what it would look like if you were to get on a plane and then connect a flight to space. Travel in space, fly to the moon. It gave people a vision of the future that could be possible. I think it was one of the interesting parts that people really love about 2001, to give you an experience, right? And in the next maybe couple decades, it might be possible. I mean, SpaceX right now, the Elon Musk company, as well as Jeff Bezos, Blue Origins, they're trying to do that. They're trying to give first, the rich people, of course, but eventually that the goal is to say, okay, I'm gonna pay, a couple $100 and I go ride to the moon and back. Space tourism, And what we thought in 2001 when that first came out in the 60s, like, oh, that's crazy. It could be possible in the next few potential decades, you could be hitching a flight to tour the moon and back.
Oh yeah, they already made the self-landing rockets. That was incredible when I saw that on TV. Like you can't make that up. That is the dream of fantasy right there in sci-fi. So certainly within the next 100 years, it'll be happening. I mean, they just had the rover land on Mars.
But anyways, that's the point, is that he was making that in 1920, like 829, a year or 1 or 2 years after this. He made a movie, the silent film called A Woman on the Moon, which is his attempt to try to make like space travel a reality, So he did another one, I think, after this. I think I've seen everything of his, Fritz Lang. Pretty sure. There's probably a few that weren't available to me 20 years ago, but I've probably seen the whole thing. His final films were pretty spectacular, really, really, really epic. Anyways, that's later on. Bob, any parting thoughts?
No, not really. I mean, I recommend the film overall.
Would you say it's like a classic of silent film, or is it ranked pretty
Oh,
high, or is it like
absolutely.
it's another?
It's definitely a classic of silent films.
Yeah. How about just films in general for you, beyond silent.
Beyond silent films? Where does it stand?
Yeah. Like, would you put it up with what we were just talking about earlier? Was that Magnificent Seven, for example?
Well, I made a list of my top 50 recommended films. It's not on it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put it on it. I would say that, in all honesty, that I think that it's more a film for people who like silent films.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I don't think it's a general. I don't think it's for the general palate.
Yeah. But I will say that it's surprising how many people who don't normally watch silent films will watch this even above beyond the Chaplin comedies. They take this film over the comedies, shockingly. Mm. So,
sci-fi. It's such a popular genre.
It is, yeah. Especially That's now, true. Right? With the Marvels and everything nowadays, people like yeah. that stuff. And this is often on, like, if you were to write a top 10 move silent films of all time list, this is on it for sure. Almost.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. Up there with the General.
Yeah. That's also another title on this top whatever list. And I would say for me, even beyond silent films, I really enjoyed it. I haven't seen it since that screening probably a decade or more ago now. And that's really made a lasting impression on me. It continues to deepen my love of silent films, I think, if anything. I would rank this above many sound films, I would say, because the technique in this film, the technical prowess, a lot of it is just timeless. You know, the way he filmed the movie, the way he performed the visual effects, the way he strung the story together, the way he alluded to some of those multiple layers that we just barely scratched the surface of talking about. I mean, I love that about films, and I love that films like this, of this caliber, is even remarkable that it's still accessible to us, right? And restored in great high definition quality, and with all the, even though it's really scratchy and not really good with the 16mm backup copy, but still it's accessible. The fact that we can actually even watch it is a miracle, right? It survived near 100 years ago now. So for all those reasons, you know, like we all said, it's definitely required viewing. Even if you don't watch any silent films, this is highly impactful for silent film, for film history in general, not just silent films. It's remarkable across many fronts, you know. Anyways, highly recommended from all three of us. So that wraps up our main feature review of the last silent film that we're going to talk about. And as I talked about it basically anticipated the last few episodes, this is kind of the final one. And, you know, the reason why is that, you know, simply that I just don't have enough time to continue in the same way that we've been going, you know, for the last, this is probably the 52nd episode year plus. We've been going at it for a lot of it week by week. And it's not the fact that it's exhausting. It's the, you know, and I love and still enjoy doing it. It's the fact that I want to do other things as well. And there's just simply not enough minutes in the day to squeeze in to do everything, you know. It's kind of like a young man's game, podcasting. With any of this type of creative endeavor, I think you got to, like, you know, have a huge amount of free time that you want to invest in and get it rolling. And I wish I did this like 20 years ago, but the reality is, I don't have that time these days, and I do have other things I want to get to more in terms of priority than this. So, and that's what we'll be talking about next. So that's really the reason why that I need to conclude and end this podcast. I will say never, meaning, like, you know, you could say, yeah, I'm going to be done forever. It's really hard to say that because you never know if circumstances could change. One day, you know, I win the lottery. You know, I'll turn this my full-time job.
Things
you know,
have their time.
Whatever. You know, the point is, you never know. But for the time being, I do want to bring it to a conclusion. And so that, you know, I want to be doing other things, you know, which we'll get to towards the end of what we're going to, you know, wrap up with in terms of what we're doing afterwards. But yeah, that's the reason. So that's pretty much it. Is that kind of clear for you guys too, Bob and Lee? I mean, we talked about it before, but.
You never know. Season 2 could be right around the corner. Whoa.
So yeah, I say never this, but you know, my hope is that, you know, somewhere down the path that somebody picks this up and kind of keeps it running. It has been set up in a way that somebody could, perhaps even you, if you're listening to this, you know, if you're interested in hosting podcasts and keep it running, you're passionate about silent films as a listener, but maybe you want to participate too. It is a bit hard work, but I think if you really love it and enjoy it, it's kind of fun. At least for me, it's been fun and still is fun. I just have a little bit of capacity and I want to be doing other things that I think I want to spend more time doing rather than this one. And yeah, like I said, I still enjoy it. I still love it. I wish I had all the time in the world to continue it, but I just don't. So I have to kind of pick and choose, you know, what I do with my time, you know, and that's what it comes
Everything
down to.
Everything has its time and place.
Yeah. So I would say that's why I wanted to go ahead and say this is kind of concludes my involvement with Watching Silent Films at this point. I do want to say thank you heartily to Lily first because she said yes to, you know, agreeing to start recording this on a whim, on a lark, as it were. You know, first contact, I didn't know. I mean, you never know with, and we're literally just, you know, initially strangers on the internet. So, but now we're kind of familiar. We know how, you know, we can do the co-hosting of the podcast, and you got some experiences under your belt, Lily, between you and me, and now we added Bob in there 5 or 6 episodes in. So thank you, Lily. Thank you, Bob, for really making this all of this possible. It's just one of the dreams come true, really, for creating something. I think before this, I don't think I've ever in my life created anything creative, just in general, like this. So this is a very creative endeavor, and I love doing it, and I loved producing, creating, recording this podcast with you, Lily, and Bob, and all the guests that we've had on in the past. And so I thank you, Lily, and thank you, Bob. I probably don't say that enough on the podcast itself. So,
yep.
So, well, thank you.
And thank you for having us, or me at least. I appreciate being involved, and you're asking me if I want to be involved. So, thank you.
And yeah, both of you added tremendously to the value of podcasts, and honestly just made all of this possible. So, again, very much thank you for both of your time and involvement and making all of this possible, and Lily for posting things and maintaining all those things afterwards and writing in, taking notes in the descriptions and stuff like that. So
I like it. It's fun.
Any parting thoughts before we move on to kind of, you know, what we're going to do afterwards, what we're going to work on?
Well, I'll throw in my thank you for, you know, also wanting to do this because, you know, being one of the younger people on this podcast, I'm pretty sure not many people my age in their mid to late 20s are into silent films, given that, you know, they are practically 100 years old or are over 100 years old. This really opened my eyes to, like, today's film industry, which is what I'm trying to pursue. So it's nice to see our past throughout the world when it comes to filmmaking and what we do now, as you know, we were saying with Metropolis, all these, film techniques that he was doing, you know, 95 years ago, and some of them we still use today. So, I have watched a lot of films in the near 2 years we've been doing this podcast. So, that's more inspiration for, you know, creativity. Like, I am a writer. I do write a lot. So having and knowing that these films exist, not saying, like, obviously no copyright infringement, but seeing, you know, stories of the past and bringing them kind of forward in the future and using what you've learned and seen, you can kind of, I don't know, it's very inspirational. And that's Colin, all I have to say. Silent films aren't dead. They're not, you know, obscene. They're not horrible. They're of value, and I think more people need to appreciate them. You know, there's only so many silent film festivals out there, and it's a forgotten art, and really it should be brought back up to speed in our modern time, because you don't always need dialogue to have a story progress.
I bet you've seen more silent films in the last couple of years than you have modern films.
Yes.
Based on what you've told me, you only watch movies in bits and pieces, right? Except that this podcast has forced you to watch complete movies of the silent era. So you probably have seen, you've seen complete movies of the silent films way more than you've seen the modern movies.
Well, if they're not totally complete, can we really say that?
That's what I'm saying. You still saw as much of the footage of the films that you have, right? For silent films that you can have access to versus a lot of the modern films, from what you're saying, that you've only watched bits and pieces of.
Yep.
So we've done you right by having you watch complete movies.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, all right, guys. So I'm going to get to kind of taking us out with what we're going to work on next. I have been recording. I'm going to post all of this soon. Hopefully by the time you're listening to this, it'll be out. But I'm working and have been working on this other passion of mine. Again, more podcasting. And it's called Classic Science Fiction Literature Podcast. And our goal and focus is to read either short stories or novels of classic science fiction era. Books, things like Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, Heinlein, and you know, all those greats. All those greats. Bradbury and on. So
H.G. Wells?
Perhaps. Actually, that's the prototypical science fiction. H.G. Wells and Jules Verne, those are predecessors of the modern golden age of science fiction, I call it.
Yeah.
Which reigned from the 30s, 40s, and 50s and beyond. So still in the old stuff. Yeah. So that's, if you search for it on Apple or any podcast, wherever you get podcasts, to search for Classic Science Fiction Literature Podcast, and I think you'll be able to find us along the way. That's what we'll be doing after this. And by the way, if you are still interested in you have a silent film itch to fill, as it were, there's two places I recommend you go as listeners. Even though this podcast might come to end, you can check out Movies Silently. Fritzi is doing has been doing an amazing job, and I think she has a Patreon as well. Highly recommend all the stuff she's doing, both on her review site as well as her own Patreon. I think she does some audio, perhaps podcasts. I don't really know. I didn't really look into it. But if you're looking for kind of a replacement, as it were, or something to kind of continue to fill your void of silent films, I highly recommend her stuff. Whether it's the reading through what she's written, or I think she has some additional content behind the Patreon wall. But go check her out. Nothing like it. It's, you know, I would even say that's better than what we do here, because in the sense that she goes really deep. Like, she's read hundreds, if not at this point, thousands of silent films. And her depth of knowledge is just second to none in terms of silent films. She can tell you about all sorts of film techniques that have occurred prior to even the height of silent films in 1927 and so on. So highly recommend that. We've referenced her throughout our journey in the podcast here. And certainly if you want to sort of have a patronage somewhere, that's the place I highly recommend to go to for silent film needs. Now for the classic film needs, I highly recommend checking out Mike Gebhard's Nitrateville. He has a Nitrateville podcast. Just search for Nitrateville, or just search for Nitrateville Google, and he's a forum that he maintains I'm often frequently on there, chatting in the silent sub forum as well. So you'll still see me on there asking questions and stuff like that. So highly recommend you check that out. They talk about vintage films, so it'll include talkies as well, in addition to silent films. But he does often talk about silent films. So those are the two places that I'd say that I subscribe to get my vintage film stuff to fixes, you know. So that's pretty much it for me. So what you working on, Lily? What's next for you?
Well, I'm not always 100% sure about the future, but right now I am a part of a upcoming, I would say, production company based out of the Worcester area in Massachusetts. We're called Pure Dice Films. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram. We have a website.
YouTube.
Do we have a YouTube? We do have our YouTube page. Yeah.
You have the search for
You know over me. Pure Dice. I don't know.
Yeah.
But we have we've had a lot of very good reviews and compliments. Well,
that's where you can watch your stuff, right? Pure Dice, that's where you can watch your stuff is on YouTube.
Well, we have our website, we have our other things, but yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh.
And that's it.
Awesome. And Rhubarb, what you have been working on? And
well, a hobby hopefully turned profitable is I design board games. I've done it all my life, and I've been working on a game for the past 6 to 7 years now that I'm hoping I'll have complete soon and on the market. It's called Sword of Legends. And it's a fantasy.
You didn't change the name, right? It's going to be the same name, right? So people can find it.
It will be Sword of Legends. Yes.
Okay. Good. Good. Good.
Just and it's a fantasy strategy board game. Pretty deep thought. Hopefully easy to play. I'm hoping that'll be done in a few months from now.
Awesome.
And on the market. And where it'll be on the market, that's kind of hard to say, but hopefully it gets around before your eyes.
Yeah, wherever you get board games from, I'm sure it'll be there. What's it called? Sword of Stones?
Sword of Legends.
Sword of Legends. Sword of Legends. So wherever you get your board games from, Sword of Legends. Look for it coming soon.
My company is called Katazeev's Workshop.
Hmm.
Well, you're going to have to spell that, Bob.
I'll spell it for them.
Katazeev's Workshop. He's a wizard. That's all he needs to remember.
Okay. All right, so that's what we're working on next. And that's it for us. My name is Yifeng, and it's been swell. It's been great. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you for having us along.
Yeah, thank you, Lily. Thank you, Bob. And thank you, listeners, for making all this possible and allowing us to kind of just chat and hopefully drop some knowledge along the way. If not, you can just enjoy the sound of my voice. Right?
It's an enjoyable voice.
Yeah. Maybe I'm just making it for myself and I just listen to myself right now. So thank you, everybody. And we're going to take us out from here. And goodbye. Auf Wiedersehen. Au revoir. However you, sayonara, however many languages you can say. And take us out. Thanks, everyone. Goodbye.
Good night.
Bye. Take care.